Say, through all tenders, the experience that the soul has at the time of death, while leaving the body, the same experience one has when he rises into the beyond and just into the mysteries of the beyond. So this is what he meant by dying daily. By dying daily means just to draw our attention. It is your expression of a soul in man, in us, from outside. First withdraw from outside and enter within the laboratory of man's body. First thing you see from the burning rays of the sun, when you enter some house, you feel rest. Similarly, when you withdraw your attention from outside, just enter within the man's body, concentrate there, you feel rest and little desire. But that is also not sufficient. You have to rise above senses. You have to rise about your own faculties. There are five in number. The faculty of sight works through the eyes. The faculty of the hearing works through the ears. The faculty of smell works through the nose, nostril. The faculty of taste works through the tongue. And faculty of touch is worked through the skin. So there are five outward faculties working through the five organs of sense. So that our attention which is going out through these outward faculties into the world is that in the dawn from outside within, you feel that. But that is not sufficient. You must learn to rise above the outward faculties. And it all ends up to the level of the eyes. So you will find at the time of death, soul is withdrawn from below, rising above. Yes, our eyes are upturned and Lord drops himself to the seat of the soul in the body, is at the back of the eyes. So it is a matter of practical self-analysis. If you go to some intellectual people, what do they say? Well, it is not actually leaving the body, but it is just forgetting your eyehook. So similarly, when you rise above body consciousness, what do you find? Life may not accept you be born anew, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. Nicodemus, who was the ruler of the place, came up to Christ and said, Lord, I am an old man, how can I enter the womb of the mother and be reborn? And the Christ told him, flesh is born of the flesh, and spirit of the spirit. Flesh is born of the corruptible seed, and spirit is born of the incorruptible seed. Just to be born in you means rising above body consciousness, after learning how to leave the body at will. So this has been the teachings of the other masters also in other countries. The same man must be twice born. What do they do at the time? They are the regular custom for that. Children of 5, 6, 7 years old are made to sit and just to give an experience how to rise up above body consciousness. First birth is in the flesh. And the second birth is into the beyond, above it, rising above body consciousness. So these are the writings of the masters that they have been given out from time to time, but the intellectuals do not give the right justice to the work, because they have had no experience of all these things. So similarly you find all masters, they say, God appears within the man body. If you just tap inside that Emerson says, are you right above body consciousness, or you be reborn, you enter the kingdom of God. So kingdom of God cannot be had by observation, by outward ways of knowing God, which form part of reading the scriptures and performing the rites and rituals, and were saying prayers. So each has its own scope. By reading sequence, we insist to create in us an interest to have the same experiences as the Master had in their life. Their scope is there. In performing the various rites and rituals and saint prayers, go to develop in us love and devotion for God. So their scope is there too. So now, on the wings of love, we can fly into the heavens. These are the preparation of the ground and the length for a higher purpose. The next step that we have to take is to be born anew. I learn to die so that we will begin to live. So all masters are like that. So what will you find that? Well, that God who was worldless, when it came into being, there were vibrations, and there were two things manifest there. God is light and sound sensible. You find God is called light. And God, the works of God, these two things, light and sound principle, we find when we just rise above body consciousness, are born into the beyond. To enter the kingdom of God is to just enter first within the laboratory of man body, then to rise above body consciousness, and there are planes and planes and so many planes. There are so many mansions in the house of our Father. There's the astral plane, there's the causal plane, there's the super causal plane, and the spiritual plane. The soul rises into the world, though it is very hard for those who are given up to the outward enjoyments. For that they have a pure heart. That's why people say, blessings are bestowed in heart, for they shall see God. All other masters say the same thing. Buddha, they say, that the Eightfold Path, Buddha, is meant for the preparation of the ground. Sarvana Dimavut also you find this is used the same thing. And all other masters also say it's the same thing. We must have pure purity of heart, who would like to have entered the kingdom of God. So, therein you find manifestation of God in two aspects. One, you find light of God within. And the other, you hear the voice of God within. So light of God, you see, you find in the scriptures, if you search the door of the temple of the body, you see the light of heaven. Other masters say, when you're outward, outside, outgoing faculties are withdrawn from outside and inverted within, you find the light there. You also find further that I, the light of the body, is thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. So how the two eyes can become single? It is a practical subject. This is only opens the inner eye, which can be just withdrawn from outside, so lying above body consciousness or the senses. That eye is open. The single eye is within all. It is closed, you see, so far. Our inner ears are also sealed, as the scriptures tell us. Now there should be somebody who could break those seals and enable us to open the inner eye to see the light of God and open the inner ears to hear the voice of God. Even the blind men, now they have no outer eyes to see, they have also that single eye within them. So you'll find if that inner eye is opened, they also can see the light of God. So Guru Nanak defines who is a blind man. He does not say those who have no eyes on the face, but he says whose inner eye or the single eye is not opened. He is truly a blind man. So man may have the outer eyes or not, still he has got that inner eye to see the light of God. If that opens, he has light within, and he can see it. He can also hear the voice of God with it. So that is why Master once Christ told his disciples, blessed are ye that see things what the old prophets and the righteous men could not see. Blessed are you that have the things which the old prophets and the righteous could not hear. So there is something to see and something to hear of the two aspects of God. God is light, God is unspeakable. So you will find the various masters telling us the same thing, all speaking of the light and sound principle. Socrates heard within him a peculiar sound, which would bring irresistibly into the higher spiritual regions. With Plato also refers to it as the music of the spheres. Pythagoras also talked of that in the sky god, supreme music of the nature of all harmonies. And God to him was absolute truth, clothed in light. The Zoroaster assignment in well faith of the greatness of the God of light, they taught the people to do so. They keep fire burning all the time in their temples. They unstuck fire. It also refers to the Sarosha. So Sarosha is the cause of all peace in the world. Here in the Bible we find that word is the cause of all peace in the world. The Hindu scripture defines Shabda and Nama is the cause of all peace in the state of the world. In modern literature we find the same thing. Karma is the cause of everything. So all have been speaking about life and sound principle of God. So you find in Bible too, the word I world is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. We also refer in the Revelation, they heard thunder and the heart burst flame with harps. So I by referring all these things to you, what I mean, that the basic experiences that the masters had from time to time when they came, they gave out the same thing. They had that competency to show to other people, to enable other people to have the same experience of light of God and hear the voice of God as they had themselves. So you'll find all masters who came before, they say, Son knows the Father, and others whom the Son gave. So all outward temples of the various religions, they are made after the model of man. Many of the temples are dome shaped like Hindus' temples, like heads of the man body. The masks of the Mohammedans are Korat shaped. They have got masks like that. And the churches are cross shaped or nose shaped, and you'll find in all of them they keep symbols of two things, one the angle of light, and the other sound principle in the form of bells or drumbeats. So the outer models were made after the image of man's body, showing that such like light and such like sound principle is reverberating within your own self. The outer models were made only as a model to show like that, so long as their respectable masters know the pain to them, they made them see, open the inner eye to see the light of God and hear the voice of God which is reverberating in our own temples of the man body which is God-made. So the question now arises, how to enter the liberty of man body? All masters say, macrocosm in the macrocosm of the man body. God is eyes in the heart. God is light, God is sound principle. So if we just have recourse to the outer methods to help them create in us an interest to know God by reading scriptures and by performing rites and rituals and saying prayers, we develop in us love and devotion for God. These are all good actions. They are meant for the preparation of the ground, but we have to take further steps. So just rise above senses, open the single eye within us, which is called the third eye, or the latent eye, and the Kivneta, another scripture. So that eye opens, you see the light of God. Even children they can see the light of God. So there are methods on how to rise above body consciousness. There are man-made goals which are difficult, hazardous, and time-consuming. We are relatively not fit for them. So master brain in natural age, even a child, an old man, everybody can see it. Simply that does not involve the breathing, pranas, but simply withdraw human impetus to rise above body consciousness and open the inner eye to see the light of God. So that happens all in all very this minute you. The only thing is before us how to enter the temple of the mind body. So here it is, if we can do our sorrow, shall well and good. If not, we need somebody to guide us. So we do reference to all past masters who came in the past. They are also needed. Had they not come, we would have no testimony to bear out that really it is the light and sound principle of God. So we do reference to that. Even now we need somebody who enters this liberty of the man body, rises above the eye level, opens the single eye to see the light of God, opens the inner ear to hear the voice of God. Call him by any name you like, that if you meet him, he'll be able to give you such an experience, how to rise above body consciousness, how to open the inner eye and see the light of God. He will also open our inner ears, how to hear the voice of God, which is already reverberating within us. So these are the two, main experiences are the principal ways which can lead us to the absolute God. The light and sound principle, which is what is called Jyoti Marg and Vishuddhi Marg in another religion. In Mormonism it is called Kravya Kareem and Mule. That means the same thing that I quote to you already from Zoroaster within us. So the way back to God, so when you rise above body consciousness, when your inner eye is open, from there on, where the world philosophies end, there is a living start. So if you know how to rise above body consciousness, or is anybody who is competent to give you that experience, you will be a testimony to that. So you come to him, you see darkness through. But when he gives you a sitting, he makes your soul rise above senses, you be a testimony that there is a light of God. And also hear the voice of God. So if you have got some experience to start in, that is to dwell from day to day, just that will lead you there to the place from where he is habilitated to be absolute God. So is it possible to see the light of God? So he wrote, masters have given reference to that. Some have said, nobody has seen God at any time. Also some masters say that they have seen God. Well, both statements are true, but they are made from different levels. First stating that nobody has seen God at any time in life is deemed from the level of the absolute God or the worldless state of God. So, and that when you say they have seen God, Christ will also, as their worthy God, he says, behold the Lord. No reasoning you. Without you see, it is also enables others to see. Guru Nanak was asked whether there were a God. He says, I see God everywhere. Typically, he said so, all other masters said so. Samastha Vraja says, Mohammedan saints tell us we must be able to see God with our own eyes. We must be able to hear the voice of God with our own ears. So what are those eyes? Those eyes are not of flesh and bone, but the inner eye, that is third, or the single eye that is within each one of us. So that is, for that purpose, we need somebody who knows the way and can put us on the way, makes us rise above body consciousness, see the light of God. Now you see, is this thing possible with everyone that suggests now? Well, it is possible. Even with the blind man, with all other, It is the same as others have gone. Some have lost eyes only on account of something which happened in their life, but they used to see the light outside. Their outer eyes were closed. Some are born blind. So they are children with all that. Their single eye is in each one of us. If that is open, we can see even with no eyes on the forehead. The light of God is shining within us. Then, when we can rise above the body consciousness. So for a blind man, I would say, they have got thought coming, but your friends, even the darkest cloud and the silver lining somewhere. So blind man have done wonderful work in the past. Even now they are doing. You will find the power of our attention is diffused in the world about 80% through our eyes. So that power is not lost. They have got that endowed power with them. So they can still work wonderfully in any way which they can be put on. So there have been, you'll find, even the foolish who were just carrying on the whole governments of the country. That Rasta was in the East. There were just singers who were blind, and they were wonderful singers. Even you see, you've got even now a very great yogi who was blind for months. He has all Vedas, all of Krishna's, all made scriptures of Hindu by heart. He knows the pages and the lines of the books. So blind man has got a wonderful memory because his attention is not lost. It is 80%, and that is, he is in control of that. The conversant, we find even they have got the faculty even to recognize people by touching. So as I told you, with that shortcoming, even the blind men have got the same privileges from God. They can work wonderfully in the outer physically, intellectually, and as also spiritually, if their inner eyes are made to open by some competent person who knows the way. So God has given equal privileges to all. So I would say that the room you rise above body consciousness, all masters tell us that there are two ways. One is the outer way, which is very beautiful, which is just the way we have to log in faculties. That we log in faculties, we have so much of the attention diffused in the world. Through the eyes alone, about 80% of the power is diffused into the world through the eyes. And 14% from through the ear, and 6% from the remaining outgoing faculties. You would suppose the blind man has a privilege of having 80% of the attention not diffused in the world. There is a certain for them. So there is home for anybody. Whatever God gives, and if he achieves our past, we have survived by that. There is no way out. We have to do our best and leave the rest to God. But with the privileges that we have God already with us, we can be thankful to Him. And as a blind man, we can progress more than the other people outside you. So with these two words are my best wishes to all of you, that will hope for you as well. There is nothing to be disheartened. So this very talk perhaps will freak you to your ears, so there was no eye to see, and perhaps to the other system, by just making something to make you understand what I now convey to you the message. So my best wishes are with you all. We are all children of God. As a man, he has the right to know God. God has given us privileges like that. Some have got more, the others have less. But as I told you just now, that those who have got no eyes outside, they have got more privilege than the other people too. So it might be asked, how can we, what steps we have to take in the way of knowing God? So first step is our parts, the carbonic reservoir of our heart, is full with the impressions we receive from the outside, through the outer faculties. So as I told you, 80% of the impressions are just received to the eyes, then 14% to the ears, and 6% from the other outgoing faculties. So, our reservoir of the subconscious mind is overflowing with the impressions being received from the outside. When having fixed in contestations, some thoughts come of themselves about which we never dreamed them. What are those impressions of the thoughts that you have been receiving through the outgoing faculties? So first as the Vedanta is just to defeat those impressions which are already within us by having the same way by which those impressions have been embedded in us. That is by having the sweet remembrance of outside things. So first step to go about is to get the reason for him secretly. With all love, with all devotion. So much so that no other thoughts can just enter your mind. To deceiving your heart is one in which no other thought involved just happens there. So it's such a heart with the know that will come only by the constant sweet remembrance of God. And by sweet remembrance of God, you will develop love in you. And love is the way back to God. God is love, and love is God. Our souls being of the same essence as that of God, we are also love personified. And the way back to God is also through love. So the Bible says, those who do not know love shall not know God. And as they say, those who do not understand love cannot understand God. St. John said he would let his school to give a talk. He went over there and began talking. He told them, love, why love one another? So the many of those inhabitants have repeated the same words, why love one another? Third time too, he said the same thing in Pep Quest. The other people asked him, well, haven't you anything else to say? He said, I've said everything. Love with all things shall be added unto you. Love God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength. Since we love thy neighbor and love thy all creation, with all glory that resides in every heart. And who of the six tell us, hear ye all. Aye. Irrespective to what tell us, so we know by telling you the truth, though God can only be fulfilled through love. So for this purpose of developing love, there are ways and ways. First is just to read the scriptures. The other is just to perform certain rites and rituals and same prayers, that it can develop the love in us. And the best of all is to just sit by somebody whose soul is overflowing with the love of God. You see, love can be contracted like infection in the company of others who are lovers of God. It is just like that is read about the energy. You might read many books on energy, but you cannot see so energy what it could be. You just begin to sit by the wrestlers to a grant that energy within himself, he may not be speaking you anything at all by being in his companies. You would like to become that energy appears to you just overflowing from that mad body. So the best way is just to sit by the feet of somebody who is a true lover of God. Guru Ramadas tells us, if you got a man body and he has not dwelt in love for God, our lives may be put under for curses on that. So what to do? He says that sits by somebody who is overflowing with the love of God in his company, he will dwell the love of God. When you have got so much of love that in your dreams you also dream of that. When you go into sound sleep, you may remember the same words of God. So Kavi says, if you find anyone like that, who even in a deep state of sleep, and you embrace the name of God, he says, I will be ready to give my skin for the tomb of such a merit. So now we embrace that to God. So that is the love, I think, we can dwell in the sweet members of God and in the company of those who are lovers of God. So if you do that to God. Thank you so much for your patience.
Good morning and welcome to the Satsang for Master Kirpal Singh. The recording you listened to was the last 30 minutes of Master's Message to the Blind, which was given on November 11, 1963 in Louisville, Kentucky. Our reader this morning is Michael Brown. Hello, Michael.
Thank you and good morning, all. Today I will continue reading from Master's book, The Mystery of Death, beginning where I left off on page 77. Now, let us have a look at the inevitable process of change called death. This transference from one state of life to another is a necessary adjunct of life and takes place in its own good time with a swift and stunning suddenness, the more so when it is least expected. Death knows no calendar, and no one can predict it, nor can anyone escape from it with all his cunning and wit. Each living thing has its own allotted span of lifetime. We all live, move, and have our being in time, and when the sands of time run out, this change comes and continues to do so, time and again, until one gets beyond the furthest bounds of time and arises into timelessness. Death, then, is something terribly real and unavoidable. It perhaps seems to be the only real thing in the midst of the unrealities of the world. Everyone, rich or poor, king or beggar, young or old, healthy or diseased, has to pass through death's trapdoor, whether one likes it or not. One may live long or short, 100 years or just a while. But one cannot live on eternally in one and the same life form, which in course of time is sure to decay and become wearily burdensome, a millstone around the neck, as it were, and one in sheer desperation may cry out in anguish for a quick riddance from the heavy load hanging around the self in him. Neither kings nor beggars remain. All go, each one in his own time. Ramkali M. 1. A Muslim darvish therefore advises, all thy life thou hast bemoaned the death of others. Why not thou sit for a while and ponder over thy own fate? Is death a painful process is the question. Generally speaking, it is so with most. The scriptures tell us of the excruciating pain that a dying person suffers at the time of death. In the Bhagavad Purana, it is said that one experiences the horrors of death pangs as if one is bitten by a million scorpions at once. The Holy Quran likens the throes of death to the condition of a person when a thorny hedge were to be pulled through the alimentary canal from one end to the other. The Sikh scriptures also speak in much the same strain. The life currents are wrenched out. All such statements are merely illustrative of the immensity of the torture that one experiences when the demons of death appear to forcibly take the spirit out of the body. What actually happens at that time, it is only the dying man who knows. No one, after the actual experience of death, has ever returned from across the borders of the Deathland to tell us of the exact nature of his sufferings. Each one suffers unto himself and becomes silent forever. To be on the deathbed is a veritable nailing on the cross, and the death chamber is a charnel house. One can hardly stand unmoved when some people toss restlessly for days on end with a death rattle in their throat, writhing in extreme agony on the deathbed. Who can assuage the tortures of death? All stand helplessly by. The best of physicians administering drugs to the last, the attendant nurses standing on toe tips, the nearest of kith and kin with tearful eyes and woebegone looks and somber faces awaiting the inevitable end. Who hears the piteous cry of the poor victim and his life companions, his wife and children. As the wife with hair's disheveled moans, the solitary spirit wings its way alone, Kabir. Of Alexander the Great, 356 to 323 BC, king of Macedonia and conqueror of the world as known at the time, it is said that it had been prophesied that he would die only when the earth would be of steel and the sky of gold. As neither of these phenomena could be possible, the king was lulled into a false sense of perennial security. He imagined and believed that, like the Olympian gods, he was immortal. After long and wearisome campaigns in the Far East, as he was passing through the desert near Babylon on his way back to Greece, he was stricken with fever. Being unable to hold on to the saddle, he was helped to dismount, and one of the generals spread his steel coat of mail on the ground, lined as it was with velvet on the inside, and made the king lie thereon and held up outstretched his gold-embroidered umbrella over his face to protect him from the scorching rays of the fierce desert sun. It was then that the great hero of many a battle, the invincible conqueror, realized that his end was near, for he was now lying on the steely ground with a golden awning over him. He was overtaken by consternation. Addressing the best of the physicians who were attending upon him, he with tearful eyes begged that something should be done to save him for the time being, so that he could reach home and meet his mother, whom he greatly loved. But one and all expressed their helplessness. He offered to them at first half his kingdom, and then the whole, if they could by their medical skill procure for him that much of respite. But who could help to stay the divine decree? On the 10th day of illness, as his generals one by one passed through the tented chamber of the dying king, he bade them goodbye and directed that at his funeral both his hands be kept out of the shroud, so that all could see that a great emperor was leaving empty-handed, just the way he came into the world. Similarly, we hear of the sad story of a great and talented queen who ruled over vast dominions. She was adored by her people for her dazzling beauty and admired for her sagacity. She had ruled wisely and well for quite a long time. Brought up in the lap of luxury with hundreds of attendants, she could not for a moment believe that there was such a thing as death. When her end came, she was stricken with great sorrow and overtaken by poignant grief. The royal physician by her bedside could do nothing to assuage her fears and torments. As death stared her in the face, they tried to console her and advised her to prepare for the last journey. "What?" in her horror she exclaimed. And where was she going, she wondered. "Alas, to the land of where there is no return," was the simple reply. She could not believe her ears. "Am I dreaming?" she inquired. "No, you will have to go, Your Majesty." "Is there a land of no return? And if so, where is it?" "It is far off from this world," said the courtiers. "Could not you locate it for me in time? And what preparations have you made to make my stay over there comfortable?" asked the queen. "None, Your Majesty." "Well, how many of you will accompany me to that land?" inquired the terrified queen. "You will have to go alone and by yourself, madam," said the courtiers. "How many attendants will I be permitted to take with me?" "None, not one." Such indeed is our ignorance of the realities of life. We are clever, very clever, in the workaday affairs of the world. But strange as it may seem, we know next to nothing of the stern retribution that awaits all of us, and we have, like all others, to go all alone and empty-handed. "Naked I came into the world, and naked shall I go," said the hymnologist. That indeed is the inevitable fate of all. Weeping we come into the world, and weeping we depart from the world. To come weeping is understandable. A newborn babe does weep as he emerges from the chamber of the womb, for he is severed from the light of life. The light of life that has been sustaining him right through the period of gestation in that chamber, suspended upside down. This is why we generally keep some sort of light on for a few nights after the birth of the child, and whenever he cries, we turn his face towards the light Or at times we play the rattle to amuse the baby and quiet him. But why should we weep at the time of departure when on the way back to the parental care of the loving father? It was open to us to relink the strands of life in us by consciously working for that end. To this, we willy-nilly do not care to do, and the human existence from cradle to grave runs waste. Once this opportunity is lost, we go down in the scale of existence. To fall from the top rung of the ladder, more often than not, proves fatal. Snapping ties with acquired relationships of the world spread over a number of years is painful, and the departure terrifically poignant. The more so as we are quite unprepared for the quit notice that is sprung on us. We do not know how to quit the rented house and where we are to go. The prospect of being thrown out into the unknown as we take the life after death to be bewilders us. All this works up a state of horror, unimaginable horror of the worst type. This is why it is said, "Remember thou the day you came weeping into the world to the jubilation of those around thee. Live a life that you may depart laughing amidst the weeping and wailing of all." Francis Quarles, 1592 to 1644, a mystic poet, speaking of death, tells us, "If you expect death as a friend, prepare to entertain it. If thou expect death as an enemy, prepare to overcome it. Death has no advantage but when it comes a stranger." Herein lies the difference between the Eastern and the Western thought on death. St. Paul, describing death as the last enemy of man, said that he died daily, swallowing death in victory, and mockingly asked, "O grave, where is thy sting?" The Eastern savants hail it as an occasion for union with the beloved. The conclusion, however, is the same in both cases, viz., that death claims an advantage over us only when it comes suddenly and swiftly as an unexpected stranger, neither as an expected friend nor as a dreaded foe, and we are entirely unprepared to receive it or to meet its challenge. Those who are prepared for it and are ever ready, they receive it, welcome it, taking it as a home-giving and a means of union with the beloved. A true lover of God, even when condemned to death for heresy, cheerfully lays his head on the block and beseechingly calls the executioner, praying to make a short shrift of his body with his sword as he sees reflected in it the light of the beloved God. After all, what is death? Death, says Euripides, is a debt we must all pay. This being the case, why not pay off the debt and be free forever from the obligation? The body is the ransom or the dower which the soul has to deliver to obtain ultimate release from the law of retribution. To have some idea of what happens after death, let us have recourse to the scriptural texts. The masters divide mankind into four categories. In the first place, there are those who have not had the good fortune to take refuge in any sadguru, and these can form a considerable bulk. They have to go all alone, each a solitary soul by itself, without any friend and companion. All such souls have to appear before and abide by the decrees of the just God, Dharam Rai, who dispenses stern and strict justice on the principle of as you sow, so shall you reap, without compassion or commiseration. This is what is called the inexorable law of karma that works relentlessly. This law does not take any count of extraneous circumstances and admits no exceptions. Castes and colors avail not thee. One gets his meed according to his deeds. Asa M. 3. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord pondereth the hearts. Proverbs 21. 2. At the appointed time, of which no one is aware, good angels, Ramgans, or bad angels, Yamgans, as the case may be, come to forcibly take the spirit out of the body, and one has to go along with them. They escort the spirit to the judgment seat so that each has to render account of his thoughts, words, and deeds. fool, thinkest thou, that because no Boswell is there to note thy jargon, it therefore dies and is buried. Nothing dies, nothing can die. The idlest word thou speakest is a seed cast into time, which brings fruit to all eternity. Carlyle. Jesus, in no uncertain terms, has declared, "And I say unto you that every idle word that man shall speak, they shall give account thereof on the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, by thy words thou shalt be condemned." Matthew 12:36-7. All thoughts, feelings, and emotions, all words uttered unintentionally or intentionally, and all deeds done premeditatedly or casually leave indelible impressions, samskaras, or naksh-e-amal, on the tablet of the mind, and the account has to be rendered after death. It is all a summary procedure, but just, with no provision for logic chopping or argument or appeal to any higher power, nor can there be any chance of release therefrom. The one who has indulged all his life in sinful doings is sent to hell, Narak or Dozhak, to undergo the penal servitude for a particular length of time as his deeds may merit, and thereby rid himself of the evil impressions and understand the law that works for his ultimate good. When the allotted time runs out, he once again takes birth so that he may have another chance to lead a reformed life, free from the evil now washed off, and make a fresh start avoiding the pitfalls of the path. If one leads a life of righteousness, he is assigned a place in heaven or paradise, Swarg, Vaikunth, or Baisht, where he for some time enjoys the fruits of his good deeds, after which he too, once again, comes down to the earth plane. Thus, all persons ensconced in the karmic wheel of life move up and down by the ceaseless momentum of their own deeds. There is no escape from this ever-revolving giant wheel until one, by a stroke of good fortune, meets some Satguru, and the latter accepts him and helps him to a way out and to the Godway. The spirits, on coming out of the netherworld of Pluto, gradually work their way up from the mineral to the vegetable kingdom, and then to the world of insects and reptiles, and on to that of the feathery fraternity, and next to the quadrupeds, and finally to human beings. After passing through the wheel of the 84, thou hast gained the top. O Nanak, now take hold of the power of God, and be thou eternally free. Sri Rag M5. Even the devas, or deities, the various gods and goddesses who are said to reign in regions of bliss, are there on account of their highly meritorious deeds on the lower planes. As soon as they exhaust the merit gained, they have also to return to the physical world. The blessed Lord Krishna, the Adorable One, once explained to Uddhava, a devoted disciple of his, about the workings of the law of karma, pointing to an insect crawling in the filth, said, "O Uddhava, this insect that you see before you has oft times been Indra, the god of thunder and rain, and has oft been groveling in dirt as at present. Such indeed is the fate of all." Even the avatars, or incarnations, the embodiments of the powers of God, are not immune from the inflexible working of the karmic wheel and are called to judgment. Like a soldier in the army, an avatar is not immune from liability under the civil law, in addition to his obligations under the military law governing his profession. Even if he may be doing his duty under the command of his superiors, which is law unto him under military regulations, he may incur a civil liability under the civil law. His is a twofold responsibility. One under the army law, to wit, to obey implicitly what the officers order him to do on pain of being court-martialed, and the other under the civil administration if, in a discharge of such duties, he is found to have exceeded the limits. Gods and goddesses and the incarnations of various god powers are therefore included in this category, so far as the law of karma goes. With all their privileged position, they and their entire host of angels are under the law and not above the law. This is why they too seek human birth, in which lies the possibility of escape from the toils and struggles on to the abode of peace eternal and life everlasting. Even the great rishis, with all their austerities and penances, when their end draws nigh, wish and aspire for a human body in preference to celestial abodes in heaven, as the shining ones, devas. They do so because it is in this way alone that they stand the chance of contacting a Satguru, getting instructions from him, and rising above the inexorable law of causation or action and reaction. Heroes like Arjun and the Pandava brothers accept Yudhishthira, the Dharamputra, the embodiment of Dharam, as he was commonly known and believed to be, were cast into the nether regions for engaging in a war, though of righteousness, and in joining by no less a personage than the blessed Lord Krishna, because in doing so, they could not, with all his exhortations, divest themselves of the idea of doership. Again, of Lord Krishna himself, it is said that he met his death by the chance arrow of a bill, thus requiting his past karma commitment ages before as Rama, who killed the invincible Bali, a forest prince, by the artifice of shooting an arrow from behind the cover of a tree. Rama and Krishna, it may be mentioned, were both incarnations of Lord Vishnu in different ages. Similarly, of King Dasarath, the father of Rama, it is said that one night while hunting in the forest, he heard the gurgling sound that appeared to him to be of some wild animal lapping water close by among the rushes and the reeds. Guided by the sound, he directed his arrow in that direction, hitting a young man, Sarvan, who had gone to the riverside to fill a pitcher with water for his blind and thirsty parents, whom he was carrying in a pannier across his shoulder, and had just left them at some distance. Hearing the piteous, anguished cry of his victim, the king rushed toward the dying man, who told him of his plight and begged him to take the water to his parents. Full of grief, the king went to the aged couple and told them of the mishap. They could hardly bear the shock and died, bemoaning their lot, wishing the same fate as theirs for the unknown perpetrator of the crime. In course of time, the king also met the same fate when he died in bitter agony caused by the pangs of separation from his son Rama, who had been exiled for 14 long years. This is how nemesis overtakes each one in his turn, meting out what is due unto him. Thus each one comes in his own way unto the world and goes out of it into the valley of death under the compulsive force of karma. In the second category fall all persons who come in contact with a living perfect master, are accepted by him, and initiated into the esoteric science of the soul, but for one reason or another are not able to develop communion with the Holy Word to any appreciable extent, be it on account of indulgence in sense pleasures or because of sloth or lethargy or something else. They stand on a different footing from those in the first category. At the time of their death, when the soul currents begin to withdraw from the body, or a little earlier, the Satguru in his radiant form appears within to take charge of the departing spirit. His radiant form gladdens the heart of the devotee, and he gets so absorbed in him that all attachments of the world fall off like autumn leaves, and he fearlessly and joyously follows him into the valley of the shadows of death. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadows of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, says the psalmist 23:4. And this indeed is his troth. Every man, I will go with thee and be thy guide, in thy most need to go by thy side. Again, so I shall not leave thee or forsake thee until the end of the world. The master constantly keeps a watch over the affairs of the disciple. He is even with him in weal or woe. He stands by him even before the judgment seat of God, says Nanak. With the dervishes, there is no reckoning of deeds of their disciples. The master is all in all, the sole judge and arbiter of the disciples' deeds, whether these be righteous or unrighteous, and deals with him as he thinks best. The father has life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself, and hath given him an authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. John 5:26-27. It is because of such a deep solicitude for the disciple that Nanak so emphatically declares, "Love thou the true master and earn the riches true. He who believes in him unto the last, the master rescues him true. Like wandering sprites, the mind-ridden roam up and down, animals in human form, devoid of light through and through." Malar War 1. Distance does not count with the master. The master power does come at the last moment, or even earlier, no matter where the disciple may be, far or near. He apprises him of the impending inevitable hour of his exit from the world, and accordingly comes to escort him. The subtle form of the master is resplendent and leads the spirit into higher regions and assigns each one an appropriate place to which he may be entitled according to his sadhana, or the practice of the holy word during his lifetime, and imparts to him the necessary instructions for further and fuller development on the spiritual path. "In my Father's house are many mansions, and if it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also." John 14:2-3. In case one is to be chastised for his laxities, he himself administers the necessary chastisement and never lets him into the torture of hellfire. The divine balance holder, the king of shadows, who judges each according to his deeds, has no authority over the apt disciples of the master, for they live in the name of Lord, which is a strong tower. Psalms 18:10. It is not given to him to pass and execute judgment on them. In all such things, the master himself decides and does things as he thinks best. The Lord taketh pleasure in them that fear him, in those that hope in his mercy. Psalms 147:11. Again, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth, accepteth. Hebrews 12:6. In brief, those who love the master are never alone, nor are they answerable to any, nor do they suffer pain. Gujriwar M3. But such initiates, who have no love for the world, they are not reincarnated on the earth plane unless for some particular reason the master deems it necessary to do so. And in that case, such a one does not slide down the scale, but is reborn in some family of pious and religious parents, so that the newborn easily gets into touch with a master saint and resumes on his path homeward from an early age without any let or hindrance. For the seed of the word sown by the master ever remains within the depths of his soul and cannot but in time sprout, blossom, and fructify by the water of life that he is sure to get from the master of his age. None can take away the gift of the guru. He who has bestowed it knows how to ferry across. Maru M1. Once the seed is sown by a saint, none has the power to singe it. Swami G. So that concludes my reading today. I was reading from Master's book, The Mystery of Death, and concluded in the chapter called Death in Bondage, approximately page 92. Thank you, Master, for the sharing these words of wisdom with us all, and to all of you for listening.
And thank you, Michael, for reading Master's gracious, inspiring words. There were 77 participants at this morning's satsang. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Master, for bringing us together to strengthen our bonds of loving devotion to you.
So now we have got the man body, you see. Masters come and say, "Well, dear friends, you have had man body so many times, you did not avail of it. You were attached to the outer world, to the material things. Now is the time again when you got the man body, just direct your love to God."